Right, hello. Welcome to the ADHD podcast. I'm Max Davey.
I'm Tess Davey.
I've got the format just about right after 18 episodes. And today we're doing a Q&A episode.
So third, cheeky little Q&A.
Final for now episode of Q&A from the Facebook ADHD UK followers, but with one cheeky little one from our new Facebook group, which we're plugging, the ADHD Science Podcast Facebook group. So a cheeky question at the end from Jamie from that group.
God, you're really running with this cheeky thing, aren't you?
Yeah, maybe I should use a different adjective.
Oh, I think you should.
Yeah, okay. Excellent question, Jamie. We're going to get to it.
I'm good.
Yes, because I grabbed you today, Tess, because it's the last day before you become full-time employed.
I know, everyone wish me luck. I have no idea how that's going to go.
Yeah, it's going to be tiring. That's what full-time employment is. That's my prediction.
Let's jump into the episode.
Yes, jingle time.
Just a quick warning for anyone who struggles, who is triggered by anything to do with eating, binge eating. That's going to be mentioned quite a bit during the course of this podcast. So if that's something that bothers you, this might not be the episode for you. But yeah, we'll get into that now. What a jingle that was.
Amazing.
Let's go to our first question, which I quite like, and you just told me that you're excited for.
I'm so excited for this question.
Is laziness a thing, or is it actually neurobiology?
So I think this is the best question, because it kind of goes to the heart of this whole thing about, are we just brains? And if we're just brains, why does anything matter?
I was going to say, isn't everything neurobiology?
Yeah, everything is neurobiology. Unless you agree, unless you believe in an immortal soul which floats separate to your brain and controls it.
No judgment if you do.
No judgment if you do, but it doesn't make any sense scientifically, that belief. if you accept that that's not literally true, it can be metaphorically true, and that's fine if you think that the soul is a sort of thing that's important to you, but it doesn't actually literally exist, that's fine. But basically, if we are all neurobiology, then basically that causes a huge problem for free will.
Yes.
A huge problem for the idea that as human beings, we make decisions and we have the appearance and we all feel like we have free will, we make decisions for ourselves.
This is very philosophical.
It's very philosophical. It's actually the problem of free will, which is a big problem in philosophy.
Yes.
However, we don't need to get deep into that.
Aww.
The point is, if we accept that we are just neurological bags of neurons and neurotransmitters, and we're just that, that's fine. At one level, that's true. But if you only think at that level, there's no such thing as laziness. Yes, there's no such thing as laziness. There's no such thing as love. There's no such thing as affection. There's no such thing as decisions or anything that gives life meaning.
And I mean, even saying that, you would be making the decision to believe that. So
in a way, it
kind of disproves itself.
Yeah, so I think we need to have a concept of laziness. I was going to say loneliness.
It's getting a bit too...
No, don't worry. We need to have a concept of laziness, because otherwise choosing to do something when it's hard would have no meaning at all.
What do you mean by that?
So we need to know that there's two options. We can either be lazy and stay in bed, or we can get up and do the thing we ought to do. We need to have the appearance that there is a choice there.
Yeah.
Therefore, we need to have the concept of laziness existing so that we cannot be lazy sometimes and be lazy other times.
Yeah.
If there's no choice, there's no such thing as laziness. If there is choice, then one of the choices is whether to be active or whether to be less active. And that's where laziness becomes.
My question is, how would you define laziness?
I don't know that you have to.
I
don't think you necessarily could come up with a definition which would please absolutely everyone. But the point is, you need some concept. Laziness is a concept that I think is inherently about choices.
Right.
If there are no choices, it doesn't mean anything to be lazy.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around this, to be honest. So essentially, free will exists or it doesn't.
Yes. Well, we have to believe that free will exists.
Laziness can't be a thing if free will doesn't exist, because laziness is a lack of decision making.
Yeah, it's a choice to do something lazier rather than something more active.
So is it neurobiology?
Yes and no.
Great.
Spoken by a true graduate of a philosophy degree.
Oh, God.
Yes, no, yeah, it is. No, I think functionally, laziness has to exist for a society, as a concept, for society to function. We live in a society.
I agree with that.
Therefore, laziness has to be a thing.
I think
whether
if,
it... Go on.
No, I'm sorry. I think if we didn't acknowledge that people do have, well, in my belief, that people do have free will, or at least treat it as if they did,
yeah,
then nobody would be accountable for
exactly
their actions.
Exactly right.
And yes, we need to, I mean, obviously this question comes with all sorts of complications, such as looking at, like, you know, in ADHD, there is executive dysfunction and the differentiation.
Yep, cool.
I think I just said the same thing three times.
Yeah.
The differentiation between executive dysfunction and laziness. And obviously, what we're not going to sit here and do and say, we need to hold people accountable for the symptoms that their condition has caused them.
No.
That's not what we're saying. Laziness, I personally believe, is a thing, and it is a thing that people do need to be held accountable for. And whether or not we have free will and the whole of life is a simulation, we can't just sit back and go, oh, well, damn it. I guess I'm just going to have to be lazy forever.
Lie in bed and eat biscuits all day.
Oh, I love that.
I know, it is great. Does that make sense then now? Now that you've kind of...
I think so, yeah. I hope that we've provided a good enough answer for this, because I think it's been very confusing.
It's very, very...
But essentially...
It's a deep question.
Ethically, laziness has to exist. Otherwise, we'd all be doing it.
Yes.
Okay, second question. How do ADHD and hypermobility relate to each other? What is hypermobility?
So hypermobility is really where your joints are more lax. So if you think about the way your joints move, some people's joints are relatively stiff and only have a small amount of movement. If you've got hypermobility, your joints will have greater range of movement. So
like double-jointedness?
Yeah, like double-jointedness is similar. So one of the classic measures of it is how far, if you take your thumb and try and pull it back towards your forearm, how far that will go. And if you can do it while the dog is also licking your thumb, gives you extra points. The dog is here. So neither of us are double jointed or hypermobile or whatever. They are related in that hypermobility is a common feature of people who are also neurodivergent in various different ways.
Yeah, I mean, this is a lot more of a biological question, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's simply that more people with ADHD are hypermobile, more people who are hypermobile have ADHD. There isn't anything else to this question, but that is the answer.
I mean, if someone was to ask you why...
I think that's a really good question. I mean, it sort of broadly... It links back to our discussion of ADHD and autism and the connection between those two, which is broadly speaking that a similar set of genes tend to cause both ADHD and autism. And one of the things we're definitely going to get onto today is the fact that autism is just a cluster of symptoms and isn't a single thing.
Yes, and that's the same for a lot of conditions.
For a lot of conditions.
And so is... I don't quite remember what the word is, but is... hypermobility, is it aetiologically heterogeneous?
Ooh.
Is that the
etiologically
word?
Heterogeneous.
Yes. That means it's caused by multiple genes.
Caused by
right?
multiple different
okay.
things.
Okay.
Different things.
Yes. So it's not a single gene that causes hypermobility.
Not a single gene. It's multigenetic, polygenetic.
Yes, that's the other one.
Multiple genes can cause it. But also it's only a finding. It's not a diagnosis in itself. There are lots of underlying diagnoses that include hypermobility. So one of the ones that's most talked about in the community is Ehlers-Danlos.
What's that?
Which is a disorder of the connective tissue within your joints.
Okay.
Now, at its most, the type 1 and type 2 Ehlers-Danlos are quite severe conditions, but there is some talk about, and this is slightly controversial in medical circles, but there is some talk about type 3 Ehlers-Danlos, which is associated with hypermobility and double-jointedness, etc., which can cause some difficulties, but it's controversial as to what the criteria are for that.
Okay, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's not like the hypermobility gene
no.
is one of the genes that causes ADHD.
No.
There essentially they're just both caused by a bunch of stuff, and sometimes those things overlap.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. In the same people.
Cool.
Thank you.
You done for that one?
Yeah.
Moving on. Question numero three. Retained reflexes. Is it an actual thing, and do exercises help? Again, what is that?
This is a weird one, and I think this episode could be subtitled Max Debunks Things a little bit.
Oh,
and this is the beginning of the debunking.
Okay.
Primitive reflexes are the sort of weird thing that babies do. So if you put your knuckle against a baby's cheek, not that you would necessarily do that.
If you punch a baby.
No, as in you just gently stroke the baby's cheek with your knuckle, the baby will turn their head and try to latch on, try to, like they were breastfeeding or whatever.
Okay.
If you drop a baby backwards, again, don't do this at home, kids, but if you were to drop a baby backward, they would throw their arms out in a kind of parachute. It's what's called the parachute reflex.
And if you give a baby a lemon, they squeeze their face up all funny.
Yeah, and that's not really the same, but I know there's a set of primitive reflexes which are present in babies and go away over time. Now, go away over time. Now, there is this theory among some physiotherapists that people retain these reflexes in altered form, and that's crucial.
Okay.
They don't retain them in exactly the same form. They retain them in some altered form, and this reflex, if you can dull these reflexes, underpin some of these people's symptoms, such as ADHD, autism, whatever, and if you can reduce these retained reflexes, then you'll lessen their symptoms. Now, there's nothing, that I cannot find any scientific evidence for this whatsoever.
Yeah, it feels a bit strange, the idea that an instinct to breastfeed makes you autistic.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, obviously that's a very simplistic way to put it.
It's a deeply odd, I find it a deeply odd theory, and I really don't buy it. I think what they're trying to say, I think there's always a kernel of truth within these things. I think the kernel of truth within it is that people with autism, ADHD, neurodivergent people have unusual responses to the sensory world, have unusual responses to anything being, to touch and to movement. And that's true, but it's not the same as you still have these reflexes from when you were a baby. It's just that you are either sensory sensitive, sensory seeking, or you have, you know, all of these very mainstream concepts from occupational therapy that we talk about all the time.
When you say that the reflexes are reformed, what can that look
well,
like?
Well, I've read the list and it doesn't even make any sense to me. It sort of reads to me like, oh, this is a sensory sensitive person, or this is a sensory seeking person.
Okay.
So I think they've just cast perfectly everyday stuff as... What I mean by perfectly everyday stuff is the sort of stuff that our OT colleagues deal with all the time.
Yeah.
And cast them, called them something else, and then put in place exercises that might actually not be terrible. They're not a terrible idea, because that's how you deal with
sensory
needs.
I mean, essentially, it's an explanation for common symptoms of both disorders.
Yeah, but it's not an explanation that actually holds any water.
Okay. I'm still a little confused. What is it about... I mean, obviously, I'm asking you don't believe in the theory.
Yeah.
What is it about ADHD and autism that means that they retain these reflexes? Or is it more of a, if you have these reflexes, you're more likely to develop symptoms? Is that...
I think,
do you know what kind of approach they take?
No, I don't know, and that's the problem, is that they sort of claim an association. There's not really any evidence for the association, and they don't really necessarily... They use words like they're linked, the two sort of are linked. And that the word linked is used a lot and doesn't really mean anything.
Hmm.
It doesn't suggest which way round the causation runs.
Exactly.
So it could be either. And I think it's often kept in people who write about retained reflexes. It's kept deliberately vague because they don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Second part of the question I feel like we should address.
Yeah.
Do exercises help?
Well, that's, I suppose, what I was saying. I mean, some of the exercises might help, but not... It's like, if you give a medicine which is not but not treating what it is that you're is actually going on for the patient, but mm-hmm. happens to help because it's treating something slightly different, then yeah, it will help, but you're not giving the right medicine.
I mean, what kind of exercises do they do?
Well, it's all sorts of kind of repetitive stuff. It's fairly standard stuff around like moving and exercising, and it's kind of lots of yoga-like things, things borrowed from yoga. It's a bit of a grab bag of different kind of physical exercises.
Okay, I see.
Not necessarily like running, but more the kind of, you know, moving your body in a repetitive way to kind of train your body to, I don't know, be a bit more sensitive. And, you know, exercising your body and moving your body into particular places is of benefit, because knowing where your body is in space is helpful, just generally for everyone. Exactly, and the meditational aspect and the kind of having to do something and having a routine is all helpful stuff. It just doesn't have to be this exercise. One of my problems with a lot of these therapy, the sort of means of therapy that are adopted by some of these professionals, is that they seem to suggest if you don't do these exercises, it won't work. And actually, the point is, you do some exercises. You spend some time doing a thing which is about your body every day, and that's probably of benefit.
Mm.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so to answer the question, retained reflexes, is it an actual thing? He thinks no.
I think no.
I think it doesn't have a clear enough definition to even begin to answer that question.
Yeah.
And do exercises help? Yes, but maybe not because it's a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Very good.
So our next question is more of a statement, so I assume you just wanted to
just talk about it a bit.
Yeah, okay. So ADHD and binge eating / emotional eating.
Yeah, and it sort of depends what we mean by binge eating and emotional eating. But, you know, to an extent, all eating is emotional eating. Eating.
What do you mean by that?
So, depending on how you define emotional eating, we don't just eat in order to be full. We also eat because it gives us pleasure.
Yeah.
And it is an opportunity to spend time with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So to an extent, all eating has an emotional component to it.
Yes.
I think emotional eating, which becomes pathological, is when you are eating unhealthily or too much because you feel sad.
Yes.
And at some level, you hope that it will make you feel happier.
But it can also manifest itself in, if you're experiencing, specifically in ADHD, if you're understimulated,
yeah,
like if you're watching a movie and it's kind of boring and there's a whole box of chocolates there, you're going to eat them, you're going to eat all the chocolates, yeah, because
really
it just adds another level of sensory experience.
Yeah, so I wouldn't call that emotional eating, I would call that eating as a sensory snack, in a sense.
Yeah.
People talk about sensory snacks for a sensory diet for people with ADHD quite often, because as we've talked about just now, people with ADHD often have an unusual sensory system, and if you have, it's like movement breaks, or it's like fiddling or fidgeting, it's just little snacks that can give you a little sensory boost to keep that gap between
where
you like to be and where you are.
It's the most literal definition of a brain snack.
Exactly.
It's just having a snack.
But it isn't just, it is, so it's definitely true that eating, the experience of eating, is a sensation that will feed your brain, in a sense. There's sort of differing opinions about whether if you have a sweet thing, that's more likely to then stimulate you and give you a bit of a high. I think there's some evidence. Some people are very kind of dismissive about the idea of a sugar high in ADHD. Certainly for non-ADHD people, the thing about sugar high doesn't really exist. But for ADHD people, I think it is plausible that that is part of what's going on. And certainly people with ADHD, kids with ADHD often have a very sweet tooth.
I mean, this might be a bit of a sidetrack, but is a sugar high actually a thing?
Well, that's the thing. For non-ADHD people, for neurotypical people, it's really not. I mean, you may feel a bit different. You may feel a bit sick if you've eaten lots of sugar, but the actual sugar high isn't the same. For ADHD people, it's a bit less clear. For adults, it doesn't seem like, I mean, how would you describe it? How would you sort of talk about it? But I think it's fair to say that that adults and children with ADHD do seek out sugar, and that there's something stimulating about the experience of just having had some sugar.
Okay,
that may
so,
be contributing.
So that's overeating in terms of stimulation.
Yeah.
What do you think the link is in terms of emotional eating we were just talking about?
Well, I think, you know, emotional eating in, and we'll kind of bring in binge eating, I think, to an extent here, is eating which is not, which is primarily for emotional reasons. When you feel really low and you're feeling really bad and you're using eating partly as a stimulation but also as an escape. So the same is true of all sorts of things. Exercise can be escape, movies can be escape, eating can be an escape, because you have this sense, overwhelming sensory experience that allows you to then forget your distress. And so I think that feeds on itself. Almost the more intense the experience comes out, the fuller you get, or the more kind of slightly sick you feel because of whatever you're eating, almost feeds on it because you want to see how far it goes. And that's a very ADHD thing, is that thing of pushing things further and further to get more and more stimulated.
So I've heard a lot of people describe ADHD people as having a more intense emotional experience. Do you think that that has some sort of link to this?
Yeah, undoubtedly that's part of it. People with ADHD tend to have more difficulty regulating their emotions.
Okay.
And so that's obviously connected. Those in positive as well as negative emotions, that's the other thing that's really important. You know, ADHD joy is more intense as well as ADHD stress. So, yeah, I think that's the final piece of the puzzle really here, is you've got the sensory aspects, you've got the kind of sensation-seeking aspects, and then you've got the fact that you're more likely to have very difficult emotions that you need to deal with.
I found another piece of the puzzle under the sofa.
What's that, Tess?
Impulsivity.
Impulsivity, thank you. Excellent. And there it all gets together, and you can see why the relationship with food can be difficult.
And so is that just all falls under the umbrella of binge eating, or is binge eating a separate thing?
Binge eating has got a clinical definition, but for our purposes, we'll just talk about overeating and emotional eating, because I don't want to get too deep into that.
Cool. Gut brain and how food affects our development.
So now we go on.
What is gut brain?
So.
Sounds like the worst Marvel Comics superhero in the world.
Gut brain is here to get you, Spider-Man.
Oh God,
you'll definitely
be
a Spider-Man villain.
God.
Those are the lamest, although Spider-Man is the best. Agreed. So, the gut brain. So it comes from this really interesting observation that the gut has got lots and lots and lots of neurons. So we talk about neurons a lot, the kind of nerve cells.
Mm-hmm.
And the gut has a very, very, very intense complex set of neurons which govern its function. So how fast it goes, you know, regulating all of the different hormones and things that break down your food, how much is absorbed, all of those things. And there isn't a relationship between your emotions and your gut. We know this. So when your emotion, you know, we've known this for hundreds of years, that, you know, when your emotions are heightened, your gut is going to be affected by this. It might be more active, you might produce more acid, all of those sorts of things.
So that it's very literally a brain in your gut, like a little, not exactly a brain.
Exactly, and this is the point, is that it's often therefore thought that there's something sophisticated about the neurology of the gut. And I just don't think we have that evidence. So one of the things that it's kind of gone on to say is that therefore, because there's lots of neurons in the gut, therefore what you eat somehow feeds back into your developmental progress.
Because it's definitely true that if you don't get enough nutrients and proteins and stuff, you won't grow as well. But
yeah,
that doesn't.
Yeah, so you won't grow as well. I mean, I think obviously, if you starve someone of absolutely vital ingredients, you know, if somebody is starving throughout their childhood, that will affect the final effect of their development, you know, the final outcome of their development. But what is startling is how good the body is as it grows up. If you think about people growing up in very resource poor environments, like, you know, refugee children children after natural disasters, who may have very little calorie intake, it's astonishing that they may end up quite small, but their neurodevelopment is often unaffected by that. They may be traumatized, and that's another thing, but their neurodevelopment will not be necessarily affected.
That's strange, because I remember reading a lot of articles as part of my sociology course about how a poor diet can severely affect a child's education. Do you...
I'm not really convinced by that, to be honest with you. It depends on what you mean by a poor diet. So often a poor diet in kind of Facebook terms, in kind of, you know...
Right.
You know what I mean? Kind of Instagram terms, is a diet which is too full of... Well, currently people are talking about ultra-processed foods.
I'm not talking what you do eat. I'm talking what you don't eat.
But what does that mean,
not
then?
Not getting enough vitamins. I mean, this isn't my topic of expertise.
Sure.
Not getting enough vegetables, you know?
It's great to eat more vegetables. Don't worry.
Remember that, everyone at home.
Kids. They're really, really good. They're lovely. And they probably are helpful. But I think we can go too far in saying that a not great, but not disastrous diet is harmful. So if you have no vegetables at all throughout your entire life, and you, in fact, it doesn't even matter if you've got no vegetables, if you have no vitamins at all, you will develop a vitamin deficiency. So you will develop scurvy, or you will develop all of the other vitamin deficiencies.
Okay.
But we don't see that even in kids who have got really quite restricted diets. A lot of autistic kids, for instance, have got very restricted diets. They will only eat Weetabix, Turkey Twizzlers, you know, and Happy Faces, you know, the kind of potato, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And anything else. And somehow they don't get these extraordinary, you know, these amazingly horrible vitamin deficiencies.
Well, how's that happen then? Because where have the vitamins come from?
Because a lot of these foods have got vitamins added to them. So breakfast cereals and other things have got vitamins added. So, yes, ideally everyone would eat a freshly cooked, you know, broccoli and... you love broccoli.
God, I only love broccoli when he makes it.
I am the boss of broccoli.
It's really good.
Obviously, it's great food. It's brilliant food. But I think we need to be careful that if people fall short of an often quite difficult to attain standard, that they feel awful about it and they feel like they're doing harm to their children.
Yeah, I mean, that's the last thing you want to do, especially if it's economically caused.
It's also not true. I mean, the evidence that if you have slightly lower vegetable intake, that's going to cause you to have poorer neurodevelopment just doesn't exist.
Hmm. Okay, so to return to the question, how gut brain and how food affects our... it's not really a question, so it's within, hard to land on.
And I think the answer is within a broad range of broadly healthy food, as in a diet which is not going to cause you major deficiency either of overall calories or protein or major or, you know, fat or major food groups, and has got a sufficient amount of vitamins in it to not get you into deficiency states. That is almost every diet in the UK, the answer is no. There is no connection.
Okay, and what would you define the gut brain as if I asked you to give like a simple definition?
Well, I don't know that I would necessarily. I think there's the gut brain, as far as I understand it, is the innervation, so the nerves which connect to the gut. But it's not a brain in any meaningful sense. So I sort of reject the question because it isn't a brain. It's just a set of nerves that carry signal to and from the gut. They're really important, but they're just not a brain.
We've got nerves everywhere, haven't we?
We've got nerves everywhere.
The foot brain.
The foot brain. Exactly. Some people have got a foot brain. Bukayo Saka's got a foot brain.
Bukayo
Saka.
Yeah, you watch it.
Him, man. All right.
No, he's very smart.
He's very smart, but he's also got a foot brain because he's so good at football. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, right. Cut this bit out. If you loved that last question about guts, you're going to love this one. We'll get to spooky season, guts everywhere. Who's ready? What is the relationship between ADHD and the gut biome?
So once again, we have to define something.
Did they just add that to Minecraft?
What is the gut biome? They may well have done, I don't know. So the gut biome is the set of organisms which are in your gut.
Right.
So they are important in your gut function.
Okay.
So if you have the wrong set of organisms in your gut, you're more likely to have irritable bowel, you're more likely to have constipation, you're more likely to not tolerate things like, you know, not tolerate various foods.
Yeah.
That's fine. That, again, in the same way that the gut-brain thing has kind of become a little bit... people have got a bit carried away with it.
Yeah.
People are currently a bit carried away with the importance of the gut biome. The idea seems to be that if you have the right organisms in your gut, then somehow that will make your brain work better because it will allow you to get the right... to not have toxins in your system, which is always a red flag for somebody talking nonsense, or to have the right set of nutrients. But we've already just said that actually the tolerance of the brain for levels of nutrients is really, really wide
okay.
in terms of neurodevelopment. So it doesn't... it's another one, it's another Max debunks. I don't think the gut biome has any direct influence on your ADHD.
Okay, so what is the argument for this theory?
Well...
Sorry, I know this is your least favourite bit.
I just don't think there is any. I mean, I think that there are kind of, you know, the case study of somebody who has ADHD and goes to a nutritionist who will give them some probiotics and that will somehow change their gut biome and they go away and feel better.
Yeah.
And so just to take a step back from... my skepticism about this overall thing. There is quite a lot of studies that have come from, actually, interestingly, a lot of studies from Iran for some reason.
Okay.
Into giving probiotics to children.
Isn't there a lot of probiotics in yogurt?
Yes, exactly. For example, lactobacillus and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And does that make their ADHD better? Now, the evidence is really hard to make sense of because everyone gives a different amount of probiotic at a different time and a different dose and over a different period to a different age group. So
yes.
It's almost impossible to interpret. There's this
right.
whole kind of, I've read a kind of whole systematic review and I'm like, you can't put these things together because they're totally different.
It's okay.
I really found it very difficult to make sense of. But
yeah.
Yes, it's plausible that there might be something going on there. But I don't think it's your ADHD itself. It's just that if your gut is more healthy, you feel better.
Yeah, so
and
what
therefore
kind of,
your behaviour is going to be better and your well-being is going to be better.
What kind of effect can your gut biome have on your behaviour?
Well, I don't think it has a direct effect. I just think if your gut is functioning better, you just feel happier. You get through your day better. You've got less pain. You're less discomfort.
Okay.
I think that's mainly what it is.
So it can... I'm just wondering if this supposed link could be caused by... I mean, again, it's that thing of maybe this is affecting symptoms, not because it's affecting the ADHD, but just because maybe you're restless because your stomach hurts.
Yeah, exactly.
And then people are like, oh, they're less restless when their stomach doesn't hurt, so that means that it's interacted with the ADHD when actually it may have just interacted with the fact that your stomach hurts.
Exactly. And I'm really sceptical about the idea it has a direct effect on your ADHD symptoms.
Yeah.
However, the jury's out. There is lots of research out there. I just can't really make sense of it at the moment.
That makes sense.
Thank you.
Eat well if you can. Not sure how it links to ADHD.
We don't know, but don't buy lots of expensive supplements. Speaking of...
Okay, this one's a mouthful, so bear with me. Nutritional neuroscience behind good foods to aid in brain health and what foods cause brain fog for ADHD individuals. I feel like we need to break this one down.
We have to break this one down.
Yes.
Okay, so what are good foods to help people... to have better brain health.
Yes.
And I think I've just sort of hammered this, but there really aren't good foods that directly will affect your brain health. That doesn't exist.
What about fish? Fish oil?
Well, exactly. But again, the evidence is not great. So people give essential oils, fish oils, to kids who have ADHD, and the evidence that it actually helps is not great. Fish. I think you should eat fish because it's delicious.
Yeah.
I don't think you should eat fish because it's going to make you cleverer.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's a primitive way to look at it, but surely there is a possibility that the type of nutrients that you are putting into your body, because they are essentially chemicals, can affect the other chemicals that are in your body.
It could, but we just don't have good evidence for that at the moment. One of the things that nutritional... So a lot of the nutritional industry, and it is an industry, is based on supplements, based on giving supplements. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the supplements market themselves as boosting your dopamine levels.
Right.
Now, the idea is that ADHD is at some level some kind of dopamine deficiency.
Okay.
And this doesn't make sense in a number of ways.
Yeah, can food direct, can like supplements boost your dopamine?
People claim that it can, but there's no real evidence that it can.
You can prove it through placebo. You can be like, these vitamins will give you placebo and make you happier.
Yeah.
If you really love these vitamins, it will boost your dopamine you'll be happy when you eat the vitamins.
So I've got, in a minute, I'm going to lay out my skepticism and then I'm going to put a bit of a caveat on it. So my skepticism is, there isn't any evidence that you can boost dopamine using food.
Yes.
Equally, just generally increasing the amount of dopamine in your brain doesn't necessarily make sense as a strategy. Why would it matter? It's like, the way I see it, if you're dyslexic, you haven't got a lack of words. You've got a lack of having the right words in the right place.
Right.
So dopamine is probably important in some of the pathways that drive ADHD behaviours within the brain.
I mean,
that's not the same as just saying, oh, let's boost dopamine.
Yeah, because boost dopamine implies that you're giving the body more dopamine, which isn't the problem. Because when you look at, is it antipsychotics?
Uh-huh.
That mess with dopamine. They are blocking the reuptake, so you're not getting more dopamine. It's just there for longer.
Yeah, exactly. So it's much more subtle than just generally increasing dopamine. So
yeah, and I'd be quite surprised if there were antipsychotic vitamins that were effective in suppressing your reuptake.
Well, exactly, but that, I mean, I don't think the nutritionists would go as far as saying we can treat schizophrenia with this.
Well, no, that's...
But they go as far as to say we can treat ADHD with this stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's great, to be honest. But let's just have a little segue into what brain fog is and what it means.
Really quickly, I'm struggling to, before, sorry, I know this is going to take us on a tangent, but I'm struggling to wrap my head around the fact that, for example, a diet of strictly, you know, cereal in the morning,
uh-huh,
sandwich for lunch,
yep,
no veg in the sandwich,
no,
and then, you know, takeaway for dinner,
mm-hmm,
is going to lead to the same efficiency.
It's certainly, there's lots of ways in which that's not a good diet.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, there's definitely a way you can edit this to make it more smooth.
Sure.
I struggle to wrap my head around the fact that a diet like the one I just described would be as good, in the simplest way of saying it, for a developing brain as, you know, you have yogurt for breakfast and then you have a really healthy sandwich instead of the one I was just talking about, and then you have fish for dinner. You know, I don't...
Well, I think...
That's just something I'm struggling to wrap my head around. I'm not saying that you're not correct in it.
No, I think... I mean, I think we've got to come back to the fact we don't know. We don't know what diets are good for brain development or other... or not. And then there's the fact there are other reasons why food might be better or worse than each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a very... I keep saying this, but it's a very primitive way to look at it, as like good food and bad food.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you mentioned takeaways. There are lots of reasons why takeaways aren't a great idea as a diet.
I mean, financially.
Financially, high in sugar, salt and fat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are objectively bad for you. You don't necessarily need to bring the brain in to say that a diet based on takeaways is a bad idea.
Yeah. But do you think that certain diets can interfere with brain development? I know that this is a question that we've kind of been around for the past few...
A extremely restrictive diet which robs you of vital vitamins and essential nutrients,
yeah,
could... But the body is astonishingly good at compensating for what on the surface is not very good diet.
Yeah, so do you think that the effect of diet on brain development is overstated?
Massively overstated.
Okay, and do you think, I'm just throwing this out there, I don't know if, do you think that the brain can, like, prioritises brain development when it comes to resource allocation?
That's exactly right. If you go back to the kids I was talking about who've grown up refugees in the aftermath of a natural disaster, let's say both of those things, it's astonishing how little effect there is on their overall intelligence, for example,
mm-hmm,
even though they've been through all of this stuff.
I mean, on an evolutionary basis, our intelligence as a species has been what's led to our success. So exactly. It only makes sense that that would be what the brain would prioritize.
Exactly right.
Resource allocation.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay, now we can move on to the brain fog thing. That makes a bit more sense to me.
It's relevant, though, because I think that there is genuinely, you know, it may well be that certain foods do make you feel a bit rubbish.
Right.
Because they make you feel bloated, or they make you feel, you know, you just feel sick afterwards.
But do you think that's more of like an emotional thing than a direct impact on the brain?
It could be both. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily just... I'm not sure that there's necessarily
a
distinction.
There's not really a line between that, because as we said in our first question, everything is the brain.
Everything is the brain. So I think, you know, yes, of course, it could be a bit of both. But I think brain, you know, brain fog is a really hard term to define.
Sure.
But I think that, obviously, it's to do with the fact that you can't get to where you want to be. You can't function in a way because your brain feels... You know, the most obvious reason why you might have brain fog is you're just too tired.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's bring that back to food. How will food give you a similar feeling to being tired? I would say it's having eaten too much, and therefore, you know, your natural tiredness will just kind of flood you.
Yeah.
Or having eaten stuff that makes you feel a bit sick, or having eaten stuff that just gives you kind of odd aftertaste or anything like that. So I think there's another reason why, you know, we do feel better after we've eaten better food.
Yeah, because you have less of that. I mean, food coma. I don't think I've ever had food coma from eating a salad.
No.
You know. So I think in that way, I mean, if we're talking about, in that way, could you look at, it's a weird way to look at it, but it's, some people would describe some foods as heavy and some foods as light. And that can be literal. Like,
I know,
you know,
about
when
that.
You've eaten, not the Elmo song, God.
Elmo's is heavy.
You've got it the wrong way around as well. Anyway, so.
Anyway, we'll link.
If you have eaten your full in salad as opposed to eating it, you're eating your full in pure beef.
Yeah.
You're going to feel less weighed down.
You're going to feel different. Yeah, exactly.
And that's not necessarily because of the quality of the food, but the weight of it, the literal weight of it. Do you think that that can cause a difference?
Yeah, I think it probably can. And also, it's a really great example. If you eat a salad with some bacon in it versus if you basically fill yourself up exclusively with steak,
yeah,
you're going to feel different after those two things. You're probably going to feel worse if you just eat steak. And in some ways, you'll feel wonderful because steak is lovely.
Yeah.
But you also will have more of a physiological effect.
But then the confusing thing that comes into that is, how do we define eating your full? Because it's not like 1 kilogram of salad is going to make me feel just as full as 1 kilogram of, again, raw meat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't make that... We can't draw a line of this is enough that it would make me feel full.
No,
this
I'm
is
not...
enough that it would make me feel full. So we can't really make that distinction between the types of food that you're eating because there's...
No, I think that's true. And I'm not necessarily an expert enough to know, you know, the details of what we call satiety, sort of, you know, when you feel satiated. But it does depend on the mixture of fat and protein and all of those kind of basic constituents of food that go into it.
Okay.
But also on your emotional state.
Yeah, so essentially we can't compare foods to one another because there's so many factors that go into it.
Yeah, I think we can in that...
You can make generalised statements.
You can make generalisations. So if you eat food which is unhealthy, and there is such thing as unhealthy food, you're going to feel a bit worse about it afterwards, partly because you know it's unhealthy.
Mm.
And so therefore you're more likely to have brain fog. You're more likely to have eaten too much carbohydrate and therefore feel sleepy afterwards and so therefore have brain fog. So it is, there's definitely something there that if you tend to go towards vegetables and salads, you will have a lower protein and carb and simple carbohydrate amount in your lunch and you'll feel better afterwards.
Do you think there is actually any weight in my my physical weight theory book? Because that kind of feels like I've made it up and it doesn't.
No,
make
I don't.
Sense.
I mean,
because also
no one's going to eat a kilo of salad.
Well, no, exactly. But you could still get brain. I don't know. Oh, I don't know. Ignore this.
Okay, fine.
Ignore this bit.
We'll move on. But I mean, broadly speaking, to go back to it, there isn't food that will boost your brain health on its own.
No.
Except that. in the longer term, there are foods that will make you feel better than others afterwards, because you're not going to be quite so full, you're not going to feel so sick, you're not going to, you know, there are foods that make you feel
so
rubbish
afterwards.
So it's
less chemical and more emotional.
Well, it is partly chemical, but what I'm saying is, it's not like a boost due to some neurotransmitter. It's just that some foods make you feel crap afterwards, and others don't. Others make you feel quite nice afterwards.
Isn't that an emotional thing?
Yeah, to an extent, yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Okay.
That's fine. Cool. I was going to say something else, actually, but you can pause this for a second.
Okay.
I was also going to bring up just briefly, and we can just go over this really quickly.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting for a whole other question on this, but there's also the link between your physical health, mm-hmm. which is obviously very linked to your diet, and your mental health.
Yeah.
So it is also, this is me just putting this out there. I don't know if it's true. No facts to back it up. Everything I say on here is just a statement.
Yeah.
A baseless statement. So is it true that certain foods can worsen your brain health by worsening your physical health? Like, even if you're not feeling bad about the food that you've eaten, if it causes... But then again, actually, I don't know, because in my opinion, the biggest links between physical health and mental health come from self-consciousness,
let's, because it's really interesting, isn't it? The flip side of the foods to boost your mental health is foods to make your mental health worse.
Yes.
And you know, the classic one is a kebab.
Why is that?
Well, because it's something that people tend to eat after they've been out drinking.
Right.
And therefore they're not actually necessarily hungry, or they don't have a calorie requirement. They're often eating it out of habit. It is very unhealthy. It is very high in fat, very high in salt, not so high in sugar, and it tends to be served, you know, and then you tend to eat it traditionally in Britain while you're drunk, and therefore it's quite messy, and it's just associated. I actually really like kebabs, really well-made kebabs. Yeah,
love kebabs. Very good kebab van near where
but
we live.
So actually, that's really interesting. If you eat a kebab after 10 pints,
right,
and you wake up in the morning and half a kebab is in your bedside table, you feel rubbish. That food has made you feel worse. You didn't need it.
Right.
It wasn't a meal.
Mm-hmm.
Physiologically, it probably just filled you up and made your gut, which is already sloshing around with 10 pints of lager, worse. So that's a classic example of a food that will make you worse. The same food bought as a meal, and we have on occasions had kebabs from the takeaway as our family meal, is just lovely.
Yeah.
It's just delicious.
Sure. So.
And it doesn't make you feel worse there, although it's not that
healthy.
As
a broad way of saying it, the biggest implication that food has on your mental health is the way that it makes you feel emotionally.
Yeah, often it's the social context of the food that's the most important thing.
Right. So if you're a happy person and you're confident in your diet, it doesn't really matter what you're eating unless it is affecting your physical health enough that it inhibits you from going outside.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Brilliant. Excellent.
Cool. I'm happy.
Great. Okay.
Are medication breaks of benefit? Should we do them?
Now, before I answer this question, I want to thank the asker of this question, because finally I know who it is. It's Jamie Gordon. Our new Facebook group, the ADHD Science Podcast Facebook group, where
join
people can ask us questions.
Yes.
Like this question.
Yes, Jamie Gordon.
It's a really interesting question, actually. Are medication breaks of benefit? So we don't necessarily, for most ADHD medication, necessarily suggest medication breaks.
Right.
We don't necessarily do so. However, a lot of people take medication breaks, and that is okay. So let's talk about... Now, I'm not talking about melatonin, for instance, which is a sleep medication.
We're talking about ADHD
medication. We can talk about it another time. We're talking about medication taken for ADHD.
Sure.
Which is, I think we've been through this before, but quickly, stimulant, non-stimulant medication.
Right.
Stimulant medication is the commonest form to be given as what we call first line.
Yes, that's the one with the hungry brain. They're both.
I mean, the hungry brain is like a metaphor for ADHD generally, and they both affect
the hungry
brain.
Yeah, I was thinking of the word analogy, but I couldn't come out with it.
Analogy. But yes, you're right. The stimulants are more directly connected to that analogy, because they will feed the hungry brain with stimulation, which is what the hungry brain
sure.
eats. So the stimulant medications, it is okay to have a break from them, and I would encourage it, not because you're getting addicted or because, you know, it's not going to work as well as before,
sure.
but because it's worth checking that you still need it.
Mm.
So, but it's more complicated than that because, you know, if you have a break over the weekend and you're like, well, I was fine over the weekend, so I can't need it during the week. Well, that doesn't make sense.
Particularly
because you've got
with
different things happening.
Yeah, exactly. And non-stimulants are the one with the subtle underlying effects.
Yeah, so the
well,
non-stimulants we'll talk about in a minute.
Okay, sorry.
Medication breaks are a completely different thing for them.
I'm on stimulants, right?
Yes.
Okay, not to talk about myself, but to talk about myself. I get heart palpitations. I got them all through my last few years of school. I thought that it was anxiety. I took a medication break after I left school. The heart palpitations stopped. I was like, maybe it's just because I'm out of school. Took them again today. Guess who came back?
Palpitations.
So it turns out that taking a medicine break was good for me because now I know what has been causing this scary symptom that I have.
Yeah, and then the question comes, is it worth it if you to have this symptom in order to have the benefit of the medication?
Yeah.
Which we can talk
which
about.
Which we'll, I'll figure
we'll
out.
We'll discuss. but that's just as a general principle.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one reason that why a medication break might be helpful, but you need to do it properly. So you need to say, okay, what's work like without medication?
Yes.
Not what's a lazy Sunday like without medication,
exactly.
Because that doesn't really make any difference.
Unless you can do what's lazy Sunday like without medication, what's lazy Sunday like with medication, then that can be helpful.
Oh yeah, of course
well.
It can be. So I think just match those
exactly,
things up.
Yeah, you want to have.
I mean, there are times when I suggest a medication break in patients,
sure.
Particularly for children if they are having problems with their appetite, because a very common side effect of stimulants is to have less appetite. And if they're struggling to maintain their weight or people are worried about that, they often will leave off the medication at the weekend. Or, actually, some people just sometimes just leave off the medication at the weekend because they feel they don't need it. And that's fine. Sometimes, though, going back onto the medication on a Monday morning can be a bit of a wrench.
Yes.
But if you can go, if some people are perfectly happy to go off on and off it, no problem. For other people, it is more of a problem.
Sure.
So that's the stimulants. Does that make sense? So we don't necessarily routinely do medication breaks, but there are a number of situations where they can be helpful.
Yeah. Okay. With stimulants, medication breaks aren't prescribed because there's something wrong with the medication, but sometimes there's an off balance between
the
positive and negative benefits, and you just want to experiment with an alternative.
Exactly. You want to see if being off medication or being on medication is best for you.
Sure.
The non-stimulants, you probably you generally should not do medication breaks.
Yes.
Because they have a long-term cumulative effect. And if you take the weekend off taking them on Monday, they will be much less effective.
Yes.
So the non-stimulants, we generally don't do medication breaks. And what we would do, basically, is take someone off it if we don't think it's working or we think they're having problems.
Can I try to explain the difference between stimulants and non-stimulants?
Yeah,
go on.
See
if I get it right.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've spoken about this before.
Boom.
So stimulants are more of an immediate effect.
Uh-huh.
I mean, both of them produce the same effect technically, I think.
Yeah, in terms of symptoms they
do. Yeah, in that you do less sensory seeking, I guess is the best way to say it.
Yeah.
You're more satisfied with a lower level of stimulation on both medications. The difference is that non-stimulants, they have, as well as the overlying effect, they have a slightly weaker underlying effect that is longer term.
Yeah.
And non-stimulants, do you take those multiple times a day, or is that?
Generally not. You're generally taking them once a day.
Okay, and that's the same for stimulants.
Stimulants, it depends. So
okay,
some people
so
are
that's
on,
just on the type of stimulant.
Yeah, it depends on the type of stimulant. And some people are on multiple doses. So some people have one during the day and then another in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
But most people on stimulants will take one a day.
Yeah, and so stimulants and non-stimulants are similar in the fact that they produce the same symptoms. Or, well,
they
lessen
the same symptoms. They lessen the symptoms in quite similar ways, yeah.
Yeah, but the distinction is the length of effect that they have.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that a non-stimulant is essentially just a stimulant with a little booster at the end?
Not really.
Okay.
Because one of the crucial differences is that the non-stimulants don't affect sleep. So you can take a non-stimulant whatever time of day you want.
Okay.
And so they're not, they're quite different in that way. And they don't particularly affect appetite in a reliable way. So I think the better way of thinking of it is that there, whereas the stimulants kind of top up your stimulation level, the mm-hmm. non-stimulant will basically reduce the amount of stimulation you need a bit more. So
right, so there's two lines running. Just like the two lines on our Audacity page right now.
And that's really helpful to the listening audience. You imagine a high level of stimulation required by the brain and a mm-hmm. relatively low level of stimulation provided by the environment.
Yes.
The gap between those two things is where ADHD is.
That's yeah, all and that gap is made smaller by both medications.
Yeah, just in different directions.
But it's made smaller by the stimulants, by raising the amount of stimulation that you're getting.
Yeah.
And it's made smaller by the non-stimulants, by lowering the amount of stimulation that you need.
Yeah, and that's broadly correct, and I don't think we completely understand the non-stimulants, but that's the best metaphor I can think of, the best analogy I can think of.
It's a very good metaphor.
And I think within the stimulants, it seems to affect that level of stimulation you require in two ways. One is a more immediate thing. So sometimes you can take it in the evening if you need to calm down in the evening. But then there is also this longer term lowering of how much stimulation you need over time, over weeks.
Yes.
That's where there's two effects going on.
Okay.
So I hope that answers your question, Jamie.
Well, hang on. I don't think we actually did answer the question for I don't think we actually did answer the question for the non-stimulant side of things. I think I brought you off track too quickly.
Medication breaks in non-stimulants are generally not useful and generally not needed.
I guess, if you're thinking about taking a medication break and you're on stimulants, just ask your doctor.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All of this whole episode should be, please, if you're worried, ask your clinician. I am not your clinician, although yes. I am a clinician.
Yes, he is. Maybe you're listening to this and he is your clinician.
Yes, in which case, hello, and I'm sorry I haven't got back to you.
All right. Well, we hope that's helpful.
Yeah, so that's the end of our Q&A. We will do another one. Come to the Facebook group and join the Facebook group and ask us a question. I've got a couple of questions people have asked. I haven't answered them because I need to do a little bit of research.
Mm. I really love making these episodes. I feel like I learn so much. I mean, not that I don't learn so much from the other ones, but I feel like I have a more active role in these.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully you can find time in your busy work schedule in the future, Tess.
Fingers crossed. Keep sending those questions in. I'll be back.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.